This message is entitled The Historicity of the New Testament, and it's given by Josh McDowell.
Today we want to cover the reliability of the New Testament. When you finish this hour, you will know more about the reliability of the New Testament than 90% of the faculty in secular universities. When you read the chapter in Evidence That Demands a Verdict, you will know more than 98%, and I'm not exaggerating, of faculty in secular universities. For a large degree of those in Christian universities. The majority of what I say will be found in various places in Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I'll just be putting a little different perspective. The reliability of the New Testament. I was speaking at a history class where the man had set it up for a debate, fed some questions to the students to shoot me down when I came in, and there were about 200 students there, and I was speaking. And the man was there, and he said this to me. I made the statement that manuscript-wise, there's enough evidence for the reliability of the New Testament, more so than any 10 pieces of classical literature put together. And he spoke up, and he said, "That's ridiculous, making a statement the New Testament is reliable." A lot of the students in the class were kind of snickering, saying, "Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous." This man had two PhDs, one from an American university, the other from the University of Berlin. So I felt I had to call him down. I said, "Tell me, sir, what are your tests that you apply to any piece of literature to determine its reliability and its accuracy?" And do you know that this man, with two PhDs in literature, did not have any tests to determine the reliability of any piece of literature? And yet he had the audacity to snicker at me in a classroom in a university when I made the statement that the New Testament was reliable? And yet he didn't even have any test to determine it? I said, "Sir, that's ridiculous. I mean, really, a person like that, to me, doesn't have a right to teach in the university. They ought to be down the junior high level." I said, "Sir, I have some tests. You might not agree with me, but," I said, "at least I know why. And as a Christian, I think you ought to know why. You trust in the historicity." Now, I'm not talking about the inspiration being God's word. I'm just talking about its reliability, its accuracy in history. I said, "I have three tests. And these tests are taken from Dr. C. Saunders. He's not a Christian. He's a military historian. So I'm not being theologically biased. Introduction to Research in English Literary History." And Dr. Saunders gives three tests for determining the reliability and accuracy of any piece of literature in history. This is why I love to have some professors say, "Ah, that's ridiculous, the New Testament's reliable." Because I've never had a professor give me any tests for determining the reliability of a piece of literature. Three tests he gives. A bibliographical in one philosophy class, a student said, "I knew you'd bring the Bible in." I said, "It's bibliographical, not Bible." Open mouth, insert feet. The bibliographical test, the internal test, and the external test. Briefly, we'll be going through these today. The bibliographical test is how the manuscripts are handed down to us. The internal test, are there internal discrepancies? And then the external test is what pieces of literature are there apart from the piece of literature you're studying that confirms the inward testimony that it is accurate? In other words, is there literature apart from the Bible that confirms the inner testimony of the Bible? The bibliographical, internal, and external. And I said to this, in fact, he was a head of the history department. This man was. And I said, "Sir, as I applied these three tests to the New Testament, tomorrow we'll do it to the Old Testament." I said, "I came to the conclusion that there's more evidence for reliability of the New Testament than any 10 pieces of classical literature put together. And this is not philosophizing. It's facts of history." Now, the first test, the bibliographical, is this. It's an examination of the textual transmission by which documents reach us. In other words, not having the original documents. Remember, they were written on material that would perish. Somebody say, "Hey, look, do you have the original documents?" "No." Then you can't trust it. I'll say, "Do you have the original documents of Aristotle, Herodotus, Tacitus, etc., etc.?" "No, you don't have. Do you have the original documents of Tacitus, the Roman historian, of Flavius, Josephus?" "No." I said, "Look, let's apply the same test." Be careful here. Most people like to apply one test to the Bible and then another test to secular literature. Never get sucked into that. Say, uh-uh. You choose the test. But let's apply the same to both. It's like the communists. They like to apply one test to a free enterprise society and another test to a communist society. Whenever I debate a communist, I say, look, you choose the test. You pick any you want to. But let's apply the same to both. So they always like to apply one to the Bible and one to other literature. Uh-uh. Like some of you say, hey, didn't you know Jesus didn't write it down, his followers did? They say you can't trust it. I say, hey, many of your classical writers never wrote it down. Homer never wrote it down, his followers did. Augustus Caesar never wrote down anything. Charlemagne never did, none of these men. That was the way many of them did it. So let's apply the same test to the two. Now it says this, not having the original documents, how reliable are the copies we have in regards to the number of manuscripts? See, the more manuscripts you have, the greater it is to compare them to recreate the original and to check any errors or discrepancies. And the time interval between the original and the extant or copy that is in existence. In other words, how many years from the original to the copy you have today? 100, 200, 1,000, 2,000 years? What? On any piece of literature. Dr. Fenton John Anthony Hort, the man that spent 28 years studying the text, said this, the proportion of words virtually accepted on all hands as raised above doubt is very great, not less on a rough computation than 7/8 of the whole New Testament. Now the remaining 8, that there might be question of the exact meaning of the text. The remaining 8, therefore, formed in great part by changes of order or other comparative trivialities, constitutes a whole area of criticism or doubt in the New Testament. And he says so that the amount of what can in any sense be called substantial variation is but a small fraction of the whole residuary variation. And listen to this. And can hardly form more than 1/1000th part of the entire text. 1/1000th is all that there's any question about it. Dr. Geisler and William Nix, in General Introduction to the Bible, say this. Only about 1/8 of all the variants had any weight, as most of them are merely mechanical matters such as spelling or style. Because see, as they'd recopy the manuscripts, the words would be, you know, spelled differently. And so in the other manuscript, they'd spell it the contemporary way. And so that would be a variant or difference from the original to what we have today. You don't spell confusion today with a K. Of the whole, then, only about 1/60th rises above triviality, or can in any sense be called substantial variations of the text. In other words, mathematically, this would compute to a text that is 98.33% pure. And men and women, in literature, that is absolutely miraculous. Dr. Frederick Kenyon, the man who is number one of anyone to give declarations about the reliability of any manuscript, for years he was head of the library in Manchester, said this, one word of warning already referred to must be emphasized in conclusion. No fundamental doctrine of the Christian faith rests on a disputed reading. Now keep that in mind. There's various disputed meanings. You know, what really is the word here? Should it be this word or this word? But not in one single case does it ever have to do with any doctrine or any major belief in the entire New Testament. Constant references to mistakes and divergence of reading, such as the plan of this book necessitates, might give rise to the doubt whether the substance as well as the language of the Bible is not open to question. It cannot be too strongly asserted that in substance the text of the Bible is absolutely certain, especially in the case with the New Testament. The number of manuscripts of the New Testament of early translations from it and of quotations from it in the oldest writers of the church is so large that it is practically certain that the true reading of every doubtful passage is preserved in one or other of these ancient manuscripts. This can be said of no other ancient book in the world. No other. Dr. Millar Burroughs, spelled M-I-L-L-A-R, of Yale, in his book, What Means These Stones, says this, another result of comparing New Testament Greek with the language of the papyri, the early manuscripts of the Bible, is an increase of confidence in the accurate transmission of the text of the New Testament itself. And he goes on to say that the texts have been transmitted with remarkable fidelity so that there need to be no doubt whatever regarding the teaching conveyed by them. Dr. Howard Voss in Can I Trust My Bible said, From the standpoint of literary evidence, the only logical conclusion is that the case for the reliability of the New Testament is infinitely stronger than that for any other record of antiquity. Now let's see what they mean. A lot of people say, well, look, we're so far removed. Why, Josh, you live in the 20th century. Why, Jesus' words were recorded almost 2,000 years ago. Separated by 2,000 years, you can't trust what he said. I mean, all the errors, all the discrepancies have come in. Why, you can't hold the Bible and say it's accurate. How many of you have heard someone say something similar to that? I hear it almost every day. You know what I say to someone like that? I use a word that really communicates in Iowa. Hogwash. That's just what it is. Let me show you what I mean. Let's look at secular authors. Secular authors. Now, in detail, this is recorded on page 48. But what I can give you is the significance of it. Secular authors. Caesar. You know, so funny. The same fellow head of the history department that snickered at me and I said the New Testament is reliable. He'd done his dissertation on Caesar. And I was just getting ready to put this in the overhead. And just before I did it, he said, let's talk about real literature. I said, okay, you name it. He said, Caesar and the Gallic Wars. I said, all right. I said, I'm glad he picked the one I could do it with. Kind of like the Holy Spirit had been leading him. I said, it's like planning a Christian audience to ask you the question, but the professor did. I said, do you believe Caesar fought the Gallic Wars? He said, sure. I said, how many people wrote about it? He said, a lot of people did. I said, uh-uh. I said, the only way we even know Caesar fought the Gallic Wars is that he wrote about it. And this guy had done his dissertation on it and didn't even know it. And yet it's taught in the university as accurate history. And I said, sir, from the time he wrote to the closest manuscript we have is a millennium, 1,000 years. In other words, all the other manuscripts have died away. Everything that we have in Caesar and the Gallic Wars is from a manuscript 1,000 years after he died. This man didn't even know it. Plato. From the time Plato wrote to the closest manuscript is 1,200 years. In other words, all the manuscripts have been lost. Tacitus, a second century Roman historian, wrote his annals in the second century. And the closest manuscript is 1100 A.D., 1,000 years after he wrote. Pliny the Younger, Plinius Secundus, wrote his history around 61 A.D., and the closest manuscript is 850 A.D., that's 750 years. Thucydides. Many people say that Thucydides is one of the most accurate historians of antiquity. He wrote his history between 460 and 400 B.C., and the closest manuscript we have is 900 A.D., and yet they teach it as one of the most accurate historians, yet there's 1,300 years gap from the time he wrote to the closest manuscript we have. Herodotus, a 5th century B.C. Greek historian, from the time he wrote to the time of the closest manuscript is 1,300 years. Sophocles, 1,400 years. Lucretius, 1,100. Catullus, only 1,600. Aristophanes, 1,200 years. Aristotle wrote his Poetics around 343 B.C., and the closest manuscript we have of Aristotle's Poetics is 1100 A.D. 1400 years from the time Aristotle wrote his Poetics and the closest manuscript to it. And yet he's taught throughout the world in the universities. And yet I would say that 90% of the people do not realize the great gap. They've never studied it. And yet they're the ones making assertions about the New Testament. Well, when it comes to the New Testament, it's almost embarrassing, the wealth of evidence for the reliability and accuracy of the New Testament. Let me show you what I mean. Now, this work here, this documentation, was taken from Dr. F.W. Hall, A Companion to Classical Literature. You'll find in almost any university library. It's a classic. This is where all the documentation comes from, so they can't say, you know, theologically biased with them. Companion to Classical Literature, Dr. F.W. Hall. Now, when it comes to the New Testament, the time span, as we go, first of all, to the John Ryland manuscripts, back to within 100 years, to 130, some people date it now, 100 A.D., the John Ryland manuscripts. They're located in the John Ryland Library of Manchester, England. It's the oldest fragment of the New Testament, just a small portion of it, parts of John. But this one discovery totally wiped out modern scholarship. Men like Ferdinand Christian Bauer of the Tübingen School taught back in the end of the 1800s that the New Testament was not written down to the last part of the second century. In other words, about 150 to 200 A.D. And especially the Gospel of John was not until the end of the second century. This was taught in universities. This was scholarship, the assured results of criticism. People quoted them around the world. People started to turn their back on the scriptures. Because they said in that 100 and some years, all the myth grew up around it, you know, and everything was changed before it was written down. And then one discovery took it all the way back. And because of this, see, this was found way over in Egypt. And all your scholars, even non-Christians, will say that means that it had to be produced in the first century. And one little discovery caused a lot of men to commit intellectual suicide. As one man said, everything that I taught in the universities for 30 years went out the window. Everything, with one little discovery. The John Ryland manuscripts. If this would have been known back in 1850, this whole school of thought about the second century could never have come into existence. But that was secular education for you. Next, we have the Chester Beatty Papyri. Much more extensive, goes back to 155 A.D. And this is found in the Chester Beatty Museum in Dublin. And part of it is also owned by the University of Michigan. Sir Frederick Kenyon, in Bible and Modern Scholarship, says that the net result of this discovery right here, by far the most important since the discovery of Sinaiticus, which we'll get to, is in fact to reduce the gap between the earlier manuscripts and the traditional dates of the New Testament books so far that it becomes negligible in any discussion of its authenticity. No other ancient book has anything like such early and plentiful testimony to its text, and no unbiased scholar would deny that the text has come down to us, which has, is substantially sound because of one discovery. And then you have the Papyrus Bodmer II, which is located in the Bodmer Library of World Literature. And as Dr. Bruce Metzger says, that this manuscript was the most important discovery of the New Testament manuscripts since the purchase of the Chester Beatty Papyri. And then you have the Vaticanus. These are copies of almost the entire Bible. The Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandria, taking back to 350 A.D. Now, the Sinaiticus is probably one of the best. And it was kind of funny how it was found. A scholar by the name of Tichendorf, wanted to establish an accurate text of the New Testament. So he was traveling to the Middle East to gather information. He was at a monastery. And he noticed some papers that were being used to start fires in the fireplace. And it looked like manuscripts. So he went over and he pulled some out of the trash can. And he started looking at it and he said, just a minute, this is an ancient manuscript. So he asked if he could see the other manuscripts that they hadn't ripped up yet. And it was the Sinaiticus manuscripts. And he preserved almost all of them. If it had been a day later, they wouldn't have had any of them. And it took back. And finally, they gave it to the Tsar of Russia as a gift. And they sold it for about $350,000 or more, almost a half million, to England. And now it's owned by Britain. The Sinaiticus manuscript, all by a mistake or an accident of looking in a trash can near a fireplace. And it just blew Tichendorf's mind when he found it. Then you go on from there. And men and women, when it comes to the time span, there's no comparison between the Bible and any other piece of literature. Now they'll say, well, that's all in good, but we don't have enough manuscripts. You really don't have enough to make a comparison to correct any discrepancies. So you really can't trust it. I use that same word that communicates in Iowa. Often goes over in Indiana too. Hogwash. It really is. For example, let's go back to the secular literature. Caesar and his Gallic Wars, 10 manuscripts. In other words, everything in your university about Caesar and the Gallic Wars, everything that is printed today comes from one of 10 manuscripts 1,000 years after he died. Plato, 7 manuscripts. Tacitus, less than 20. Thucydides, 8. A gentleman came over from Germany to lecture 2 weeks at Ohio State on the history of Thucydides. And a student heard me go through this and then read my syllabus on it. And so he asked his professor, now think, this man was paid to come over for 2 weeks to speak on Thucydides. That's how much reliability they give to him. Well, this student stuck up his hand after about the first week and said, sir, what's the time span in the manuscript authority from the time Thucydides wrote and the closest manuscript? Do you know this guy didn't know? And he said, oh, it's not very much. The guy said, excuse me, sir, it's 1,300 years. And the guy went on talking, and the student put his hand up again and says, tell me, sir, number-wise, bibliographically, how many manuscripts are there for the authenticity and reliability of Thucydides? The man says, well, there's a lot. The guy says, no, there isn't. There's only 8. And this man didn't even realize it. Herodotus, 8. Sophocles, 100, not bad. Aristotle, 5 of his poetics. Aristophanes, 10. When we get to the New Testament, 5,000 of the Greek handwritten manuscripts, 8,000 of the Latin Vulgate, all handwritten, and more than 1,000 of the early versions, giving us a total of 14,000 manuscripts of the New Testament alone. I mean, men and women, when it comes to the number of manuscripts, there's nothing in history that compares to it. The closest one, as I said the other day, is the Iliad with 643. It is reliable. We have the evidence to check it out. Now, when you exhaust all the manuscripts, you haven't finished with the evidence for the historicity of the New Testament. In other words, its reliability and accuracy. This was first brought to my attention by the Encyclopedia Britannica. And that's this. You could take all the manuscripts of the New Testament, take every Bible in the world and burn them. Destroy every manuscript and every Bible in the world. And within several hundred years of the time of Jesus Christ, going back even earlier than any manuscript evidence for any other book in history, within 2 to 250 years, I could reproduce all but 11 verses of the New Testament without any Bibles and without any manuscripts. The only book in the world you can do it to. Say, come on. Without any manuscripts, without any Bible, you can do it. Yeah. The early Christian scholars, in their writings, they would quote the New Testament. And in their writings, and I documented, and I'm page 54 and 55 of evidence, documented 36,289 quotations. For example, Origen alone in his works of just the Gospels quotes him 9,231 times, 349 times Acts, 7,778 times the Epistles, the General Epistles 399 times, Revelation 165 times, giving a total of 17,922. And you can go back to the early Christian scholars, take their writings, reconstruct all but 11 verses of the New Testament. So you can just forget the manuscripts almost. And then when you exhaust all of them, you still have not exhausted all the evidence for the New Testament. Because there are lectionaries. And these lectionaries were kind of like Sunday school lessons for the early church. And they would take the scriptures and divide them up into lessons to use for teaching. And we have 2,135 lectionaries. And you can go back to these lectionaries to study the text of the New Testament. Most people don't realize that. When it comes to the bibliographical test for the New Testament, you can hold it in your hand, say the manuscript evidence is there to establish its authenticity. Now let's go to the next test. Next test is the internal evidence test. Internal evidence test. This uses Aristotle's dictum from his Poetics, which is this. The benefit of the doubt is to be given to the document itself, not arrogated by the critic to himself. In other words, in any piece of literature, you always give the author the benefit of the doubt until it's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, an absolute discrepancy. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. Now in the New Testament, this is beautiful. Because no one has been able to show an absolute discrepancy. There's been some alleged discrepancies, but almost all of them have been cleared up by archaeology. And one of the keys to the New Testament is this. They wrote as eyewitnesses. They wrote as eyewitnesses. Luke 1:1-3. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses. They wrote as eyewitnesses. 2 Peter 1:16. For we did not follow cleverly devised tales, we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses. 1 John 1. What our eyes have seen, what our ears have heard, what our hands have handled, we declare unto you. Then there's many other portions. Now, what is the importance of them writing as eyewitnesses? Very simple. Their testimony was put before the stage of the world, in front of their most severe opponents. They proclaimed their message as eyewitnesses, and they were exposed to criticism and correction by their opponents. That happens to very few people in history. And that adds a tremendous factor to its internal reliability, is when immediately it is opposed by its critics. It was open to falsification. This is why Dr. F.F. Bruce, the Rylands Professor of Biblical Criticism and Exegesis at the University of Manchester, says, and it was not only friendly eyewitnesses that the early preachers had to reckon with. There were others less well disposed who were also conversant with the main facts of the ministry and death of Jesus. The disciples could not afford to risk inaccuracies, not to speak of willful manipulation of the facts, which would at once be exposed by those who would be only too glad to do so. On the contrary, one of the strongest points in the original apostolic preaching is a confident appeal to the knowledge of the hearers. They not only said, we are witnesses of these things, but also, as you yourselves know, in front of the most severe opponents, they say, look, you know what we're talking about. You saw these things. You heard these things. Acts 2:22. God performed these things in your midst just as you yourselves know, because this has not been done in the corner. Had there been any tendency to depart from the facts in any material respect, the possible presence of hostile witnesses in the audience would have served as a further corrective. End quote. Next test. The external evidence test. Do other historical materials confirm or deny the internal testimony provided by the documents themselves? Let me rephrase it. What sources are there apart from the literature under analysis that substantiate its accuracy, reliability, and authenticity? Eusebius, in his Ecclesiastical History, preserves writing of Papias. Now, Papias was a bishop of Hierapolis in 130 AD. Now, Papias got this from the Apostle John, he says. He was in the action group of the Apostle John. He said, the elder, the Apostle John, used to say this also. Mark, having been the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately all that he, Peter, mentioned, whether sayings or doings of Christ. So then, Mark made no mistake, writing down in this way some of the things as he, Peter, mentioned them. For he paid attention to this one thing, not to admit anything that he had heard, and not to include any false statement among them. This was a man of that time confirming the internal testimony, totally apart from the scriptures. Irenaeus. Irenaeus was bishop of Lyons in AD 180. He was a student of Polycarp. Now, Polycarp was the bishop of Smyrna. This is on page 66. Polycarp was martyred in 156 AD. And do you know this man had been a Christian for 86 years? He was a disciple of the Apostle John. He was in the master action group with him, probably. And he wrote this about Irenaeus, who was his disciple. According to Gregory of Tours, he, Irenaeus, converted almost the entire population of Lyons and sent other missionaries to other parts of pagan Europe. Now, Irenaeus, in his book, Against Heresies, says this, so firm is the ground upon which these gospels rest, that the very heretics themselves bear witness to them. And starting from these documents, each one of them endeavors to establish his own particular doctrine. In other words, the very opponents of Christianity, way back at that time, did not question the reliability and the accuracy of the documents, no. But they started with those very documents to produce their own heresy. Now, they could have put a wedge into its reliability or accuracy. They would have. They'd been much stronger than trying to build their own doctrines to refute things. Just show that it wasn't reliable. They couldn't do it. Way back then, the scholars had to start with the various texts and work from it. Irenaeus goes on to say that Matthew published his gospel among the Hebrews in their own tongue when Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding the church there. After their departure, in other words, that was about the time of the Neronian persecution, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter himself, handed down to us in writing the substance of Peter's preaching. Luke, the follower of Paul, set down the gospel preached by his teacher. Then John, the disciple of the Lord, who also leaned on his breast, himself produced his gospel while he was living at Ephesus in Asia. Extra-biblical sources. In the extra-biblical sources, we go into archaeology as a confirmation. Archaeology has confirmed the accuracy of the New Testament. Remember yesterday, in the uniqueness of the Bible, I shared Sir William Ramsay that went over there to refute the reliability of the Scriptures. And after 15 years trying to do it, he became a Christian. And he came to the conclusion that Luke is unsurpassed in history, in his accuracy. And that's saying a lot from a man like that. For example, John 19, it talks about the pavement where Jesus was tried. But apart from the Bible, absolutely nothing. Secular literature, Jewish literature at that time, maps of Jerusalem, everything. No such thing as a pavement. So everybody say, look, it's myth. It's just an error. It's just dressing up the account. So everybody say, hey, you don't trust the New Testament, do you? Do you know not many years ago, they were digging in that area, and they found out that there was such a place as a pavement. What had happened is that when Titus destroyed Rome in 70 AD, the Romans built barracks on the pavement. And then on top of that, some other buildings were built after they were destroyed. And most of the archaeologists just went back to the barracks foundation. Well, some other archaeologists got a little nosier, and he went back further, and they found the pavement. They even got the dimensions of it now. And even found the place where Herod lived, right near there, and held court. The assured results of higher criticism. And then they said, uh-oh, we found the pavement. In John, it talks about the Pool of Bethesda, five porticos. They said, look, there's no reference of it apart from the New Testament. Nothing. Nothing in Jewish literature, secular literature, maps of Jerusalem, stories of nothing. So it must be myth. Till a guy was digging around the Church of St. Anne, and they discovered the Pool of Bethesda. Guess how many porticos it had? Four? No. Just like the Bible said, five porticos. Archaeology has confirmed the Scriptures. This is why men like William F. Albright, William Foxwell Albright, who is one of the top archaeologists, any archaeology book you read, they will quote Albright. Passed away not long ago. He made the statement that every archaeological discovery has confirmed the Scriptures. Dr. Nelson Gleck, spelled G-L-U-E-C-K, but pronounced Gleck, like G-L-E-K, the renowned Jewish scholar and archaeologist, the former president of the Jewish University in Cincinnati, Hebrew University, made this statement. He made it at Temple Emmanuel in Dallas about 2.5 years, 3 years ago. He said, no archaeological discovery has ever controverted the Scriptures. And that's saying a lot from him. And he touches on a lot of it in Streams in the Desert, his book. I believe if any man says that the authenticity and reliability and the accuracy of the New Testament is not established, then he would have to throw out all literature of antiquity. Unless he's very dishonest and used two different tests, one for the Bible, one for secular literature. It's reliable. Tomorrow, we'll be going into the Old Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, we don't have very many manuscripts. But I'll show you tomorrow why I believe that because we don't have the manuscripts, we can trust what we do have more than if we had the manuscripts.
This message is entitled The Historicity of the Old Testament, and it's given by Josh McDowell.
Yesterday we looked at the reliability of the New Testament. Now we want to deal with the historicity or the reliability and accuracy of the Old Testament. This will actually come in two parts. Today we'll talk about the manuscripts. Then tomorrow I'm going to spend the entire hour on archaeology. One of the greatest thrills to me is to study archaeology and to see how the negative critics have been answered through archaeological discoveries. And we'll go through various of the discoveries, quoting some of the negative critics saying it has to be myth, and 20 years later, archaeology saying it can't be a myth, look what we found. And I will give you some of these things, and one I think will encourage you. Plus, it will give you things to fill in any messages you might be giving or sharing with someone. You can be a little more specific on it. Today, I basically want to deal with the manuscript reliability of the Old Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, as I said yesterday, we do not have the manuscript basis or as great a number of manuscripts as we have for the New Testament. When it comes to the Old Testament, it's put on the same line as almost all the other classical literature. Remember yesterday we looked at Plato 1,200 years from the time he wrote to the closest manuscript we have because all the others were lost or rotted away. Aristotle about 1,450 years, Herodotus 1,400 years, etc. Well, the Old Testament is in the same category as these people. Until the Dead Sea Scrolls, now right to begin, I won't touch on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'll show you what we had up to 1948, of course. Then the Dead Sea Scrolls blew everything out of proportion and took us right back to the early times. But up to 1948, the case is what I'm going to share with you in about the first 10 to 15 minutes. And then we'll go into the uniqueness and one of the greatest discoveries of all times, the Dead Sea Scrolls. When you look at the manuscripts, we don't have the number. Because the closest manuscript that we had of the entire Old Testament was 1008 A.D. 1008 years after Christ. The Old Testament was completed around 400 to 450 B.C. So that's around 1400 years from the completion of the Old Testament to the closest manuscript that we have. That seems like a long time. But let's look at why we can trust it, even though we don't have a lot of the manuscripts. And I think if we had a lot of the manuscripts, it'd almost show that we didn't have as much reliability. The reason is in the way that they transcribed the text, the care that they took in recopying the manuscripts. Probably more care was taken with the Bible than any other piece of literature in history. For example, in the years A.D. 100 to 500, the first period, A.D. 100 to 500, is what we call the Talmudus period. The Talmudus period. Now, in these 500 years, there were men that dedicated themselves to the transcribing of the synagogue scrolls, of reproducing them. And during this period, there was a great deal of time, literally hundreds of thousands of hours spent in categorizing and cataloging the Hebrew civil and canonical and scriptural manuscripts. They had quite an intricate system to make sure that they were correct in what they did in these 500 years. For example, Dr. Samuel Davidson brings this out in his Hebrew text of the Old Testament in a dictionary of the Bible by James Hastings. Gives a list of some of the things that the Talmudists did in transcribing the scriptures. One, they had to be in full ceremonial dress. Complete ceremonial dress. If a king walked in while they were transcribing, they couldn't even look up at the king. They could only keep writing. They had that much reverence for the scriptures and wanted to be so careful in what they did. They had various requirements for even the type of animal skins used. It had to be cleaned animals. They had to be sewn just so. They could only be a certain size. Could only use a certain type of ink. And they were so careful that not one word, letter, or even a yod, a little letter of the Hebrew, would be written from memory. Not one letter, not alone a word, not even a letter could be written from memory. Now we copy from memory. In other words, let's say I'm copying the scriptures here. So then, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. So I would start writing, so then, comma, my brethren, comma, when you come together to eat, when you come together to eat. The Talmudists couldn't do that. To make sure that there wouldn't be any errors, they do it this way. S, S, O, O, so, right. T, T, H, H, E, E, N, N, so then. Comma. M. M. Y. Y. They could copy nothing from memory. They had to do it letter for letter. Can you imagine the patience? This is because they reverenced the scripture so much. They had to have either the space of a hair or a thread intervene every consonant. Every consonant. It couldn't be more and it couldn't be less than a hair separating them. And then between each section, the breadth of 9 consonants, etc. They were so careful. They so wanted to be exact in what they did. You know, they come to the name of God, Yahweh. They so reverence the scripture and the name for God that a Jew in that day as well as ours will not pronounce the word Yahweh or Yahweh. Often translated Jehovah, which is, I believe, a mistranslation. Jehovah, Yahweh. Y-A-H-W-E-H, transliterated. And the reason the Jew will not pronounce it is that this is the name for the holiness of God, for all God is in his being. And a Jew believes that his lips are too dirty to even allow the breath for pronouncing the name to cross his lips. That's how much they reverence the scriptures, how much they reverence their concepts of God. So what they would do is this. They'd come to the word Yahweh. And they'd write the consonants Yahweh, and then later as the Masoretics came in, we'll touch on them in a minute. They would write the consonants for the word Yahweh. And then when the vowels got into the text, they would not put the vowels for Yahweh with the consonants. They would take the vowels for another word, Adonai. And they'd take the vowels for Adonai, another word for God, and they would put it with the consonants of Yahweh, and it didn't make any sense. It was meaningless. The consonants of one word and the vowels of another word. But then when they chanted it in the synagogues or quoted from the scriptures, they knew what it meant. And instead of saying Yahweh, they'd say Adonai. And yet everyone knew what they were actually saying, but they wouldn't say it so it wouldn't pass across their lips. When they came to the word Yahweh, they would put down their pen, ceremonially wash their hands, pick up a special pen and write Yahweh. And Aziz Talmudis applied these and various other things to the scriptures. I think it built in an accuracy that you don't find in other literature. Then, when they finished a roll or a scroll, if the regulations had not been met, it would be buried in the ground or burned, or banished to the schools as a reader and then thrown away. They wouldn't use it in synagogue. If one of the requirements had been slipped up on. Then, when they finished transcribing the scroll, they gave the greatest authority to the newest manuscript, not the oldest manuscript. See, the common thing to do today is the older the manuscript, the greater the authority. Well, the Jews did it the other way around. The newer the manuscript, the greater the authority. There was so much care taken in transcribing the manuscript that when they finished, they had confidence that the new manuscript was accurate. And so they'd take the old manuscripts and they would use them as readers in the schools, or they'd take and put them in a wooden cupboard called a genitza. G-H-E-N-I-Z-A. Genitza. Or a lumber cupboard. And then when the cupboard was full, they'd take them out and bury them or destroy them. Because you see, the older the manuscript, the easier it is to become defaced. Through rolling, through bending, through use, the ink and everything would start to wear off and you could start to misinterpreting a word or something. And so they gave the greater authority to the newest manuscript and used the older ones in the schools and then took them out and burned them. And that is one of the reasons why we don't have many Old Testament manuscripts. They destroyed them. And yet, in the other perspective, it's the one reason why we can trust what we have. It's because of the precaution they took in transcribing the manuscripts. Now, the second period of transcribing the manuscripts is what is called the Masoretic period, A.D. 500 to around 900. 500 to 900. This was when they wanted to create a standardized text without corruption. In other words, the way that God gave it. And so they developed a discipline which is brought out in the Masoretic transcribing of the scriptures. And this is where they recreated the text from the best manuscripts in the Talmudic period and everything, the older ones. And then they had one common text. And this is when they put in the vowels. They put in the vowels here. See, up until that time, there were only consonants. And it was just one solid line of a consonant. And you say, well, isn't that confusing? No, they knew how to divide the words. Because in Hebrew, the word could only end with so many consonants and everything. It could have only so many vowels, etc. And so they knew where the words ended and started. But during the Masoretic period, they divided up the words and they put in vowels so it could be easier to pronounce in the synagogues and to use. Now, in the Masoretic period, they were very careful in their transcribing of the scriptures. In fact, this is one of the disciplines they had. When they finished a book of the Bible, let's say the book of Isaiah, 66 chapters, they would number the center paragraph. Then they would number the center sentence. Center sentence. Then they would number the center word. And then they would number the center consonant. And when they finished transcribing a book, they would go back and they would count all the paragraphs and indicate the center paragraph. Then they would go back and count all the sentences and indicate the center sentence and make a comparison with the one they just copied from. Then they go back and count all the words and indicate the center word. Then they go back and count all the consonants and indicate the center consonant. And out of 66 chapters, thousands of words, they could tell if one consonant had been left out or added out of the entire book. They were so careful in what they did. Now let me ask you, whoever counted the paragraphs of Aristotle, the sentences of Plato, the words of Tacitus, whoever counted the consonants of Caesar? No one did. But they did it to the scriptures. And so when you look at the way in which they transcribed the scriptures, you can be pretty well sure that what we have today is what was recorded anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 years ago. Now the text that we have today, the 1008 complete text of the Hebrew Old Testament, is a Masoretic text. Comes from the period of 500 to 900. It actually comes out 1008. Now the question is, how reliable is that text to the one back at the time of Christ that Christ gave authority to? 1,000 years of transcribing. A lot of errors, discrepancies, interpretations could be read into it and changed. Can we trust what we have today, even though there's actually a 1,400 year gap up until 1948 there was? This is where the Dead Sea Scrolls came in. Up until 1948, this is all we had, was a Masoretic text of 1,008. We had a couple before then, Codex of the Prophet of Leningrad, etc., but they were only parts of the Old Testament, not the complete Old Testament. Now, the Codex is a word used for a binding like a book. The scroll was unrolled and rolled up. And then the Codex means it's in leaf form, the words. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the greatest discoveries ever. Let's look at how they were found. It's amazing. There was a fellow, a little shepherd lad, was out caring for his sheep near the Dead Sea. And like some kid, he was tossing stones around when he could find them, or big hunks of sand. And he was walking along, and one of his sheep got up on a ledge. So he picked up some stones and was chucking them up there to get the sheep to come back down. Well, one of the stones went over the sheep, and he heard kind of a clink, like it hit something and it had broken. Well, his curiosity was awakened. So in a little bit, he crawled up there and found a small opening. And his stone had gone over the sheep and into that opening. Well, like a kid, he dug it out a little and crawled in. And inside, he found what he thought were just these old clay jars and things. And the stone had hit one of them and had broken and fallen apart. And there were just a lot of sticks with a lot of mud around them. So he just figured they were sticks, and so he left most of them there, just picked up some himself and took one of them along with him. And he was hitting things with it and beating his sheep back to the place. And to make a long story short, this stick got into the hands of someone and started to see that it was a scroll that had been rolled up and had been caked on the outside. And a man by the name of Trevor, a young American archaeologist, was over there, and it got into his hands before anyone else even knew about it. And as he started to study it, he said, "Just a minute, this is an old manuscript of the scriptures." So he sent a copy off to William Foxwell Albright at Johns Hopkins University and asked him to evaluate it and from what period it came from. Well, he did that. And Albright wrote back and he said this, "My heartiest congratulations on the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times. What an absolutely incredible find. And there can happily not be the slightest doubt in the world about the genuineness of the manuscript." And he dated it about 100 BC. 1100 years earlier than the oldest manuscript we had. Well, it didn't take long before Professor Sukenik and others dug up more of the scrolls, went back to the caves, and various caves were found. And in the caves, there were various documents. There were scriptures of the Old Testament. There were historical writings about the Qumran community that existed there, of basically Essenes and the political struggles. And then there were various manuals, like one called the Manual of Discipline, the Zadokite document on the disciplines among the Qumran community and the people living there. What happened was this. They found two major scrolls of Isaiah. Some of the scrolls had a lot of the Old Testament and everything, but the two important ones were ones of Isaiah. The one of Isaiah, its technical number is 1QISA. Now, any writing that you'd read in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'd see this. And what it means, one means cave. It was found in the first cave. They numbered the caves as they found them. Q means Qumran cave. The first Qumran cave, Isaiah scroll, the first Isaiah scroll. And then there's an Isaiah A, an Isaiah B, Isaiah Z. Well, this one here was a complete scroll of Isaiah going back to 125 BC. Now, this is what needed to be done. And it's brought out by Sir Frederick Kenyon when he says, "Does this Hebrew text, which we call the Masoretic in 1008 AD, which we have shown to descend from a text to about AD 100, faithfully represent the Hebrew text as originally written by the authors of the Old Testament books?" We had no testament before. Until now, with this scroll. And this is what they did. In Isaiah 53, just one chapter, Isaiah 53, 166 words. There are only 17 letters, not words, 17 letters that are different between Isaiah 53 of the Qumran scroll and Isaiah 53 of the 1008 Masoretic scroll. Now, of these 17 letters, are there any discrepancies? 10 of these letters are simply a matter of spelling. You know, as they recopied, the spelling would change, and they would change it to contemporary spelling, like confusion, K-O-N to C-O-N. So 10 of the letters is just spelling. So that leaves 7. 4 of these letters are just minor stylistic changes, such as conjunctions, etc., which has nothing to do with the accuracy or anything else, and that takes 4 more on. That leaves just 3 letters that are in doubt at all. And these remaining 3 letters comprise the word light, which is added in verse 11 and does not affect the meaning greatly. Furthermore, this word is supported by the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, and another Qumran Isaiah scroll. Thus, in one chapter of 166 words, over a period of 1,000 years, there was only 3 letters. It was even different. Not words, just 3 letters. And even these did not in any way changed the meaning of the text. Men and women, that is absolutely miraculous. And this here shows that the methods of the Talmudists and the Masoretics in copying the scriptures is reliable. And they have accurately brought the scriptures down to us that we can hold them in our hands and say they're historical, reliable, and trustworthy. Thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, apart from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we can go back to the Septuagint. You know, it's amazing how often they say, what about the Dead Sea Scrolls? Everybody seems to think the Dead Sea Scrolls takes away from the scriptures. I don't know how they ever got to that. It's the other way around. It's one of the greatest blessings to Christianity, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I share this in a lot of classes. A lot of students say, well, you know, you really can't trust the Old Testament. I say, well, look what the Talmudists did in the Masoretics. They say, yeah, but it's 1,008 years. Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls, though, found one going back 2,025 before. And do you know, in one chapter, there's only 3 letters through 1,000 years of transcribing manuscripts. It's even different. It doesn't change the text in any way. It blows their mind. Because anyone that knows literature knows that is miraculous. Now we have the Septuagint. Septuagint means 70, and it comes from the Roman letters LXX. L is 50, X is 10 each. So that equals 70. Now the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. The Greek translation, the Hebrew Old Testament. Anyone here tell me the date in which that was made, or approximate date? Between 200 and 250 B.C. 200 to 250 B.C. In the reign of Ptolemy Philadelphus of Egypt. Philadelphia of Egypt. Now, there's a lot of speculation about the meaning of 70 and various traditions on it. One is that the king called in 70 scribes, put them in 70 separate cells, and gave them 70 days to translate the Old Testament into Greek. And that's possibly the way we got 70, is just through that tradition. It didn't take place, but that's kind of what built up around it, show its uniqueness in its Greek translation, was 70 scribes, 70 cells, 70 days producing the Old Testament, if no one got sick during that time. Now, the way the Septuagint helps to see if our text is accurate is that this goes back to 250 B.C. So they can take our text of 1008 A.D. and go back and compare it to the 250 B.C. text. Now, you don't have an exact comparison because you have to remember it was translated. And so what they do is go back and translate it back into the Hebrew. And for the most part, they can do that without any question about exactly what was the Hebrew. And so this has been very helpful to checking the accuracy of the transcribing of the manuscripts through 1,000 years. It's just going back and compare it with the Greek translation. Now, the Jews used the Septuagint. This was a universal Bible. The Jews were scattered. There was the loss of the Hebrew language because of their exiles. And so they learned Greek, the lingua franca. And so this gave them a universal Bible that could be used everywhere. But why did the Jews stop using the Septuagint? Two basic reasons. One is that from the first century AD on, the Christians started to use it. And the Christians were quoting from it. And the Jews thought that was a little too close of a connection with Christianity. And since the Septuagint was being used for the propagation of the Christian faith, the Jews stopped using it. Second, another reason for the Jews losing interest in the Septuagint is in the fact that about AD 100, the end of the first century, Jewish scholars created a standard text, an established standard text of the Hebrew Bible. And it's the one that the Talmudists copied, and then the Masoretics, etc., as it went on. And so since this time they had that standard text, they started to use it instead of the Greek. It's probably good, because if they hadn't, they'd have lost their Hebrew altogether. What are some other things that we can use to check the transcribing of the manuscripts and its accuracy? One area is the targums. T-A-R-G-U-M-S. The targums. The basic meaning of targum is interpretation. Interpretation. And these were paraphrases of the Old Testament, copying the scriptures of the Old Testament, put into kind of commentary form. And we can take the targums of today, the oldest ones we have, and go back and compare them with the Dead Sea Scrolls and with the Septuagint to see how accurate they are. Then you have not only the targums that helps in vindicating the genuineness of Hebrew text, but you also have the Mishnah, M-I-S-H-N-A-H. This is around 200 A.D. These were explanations of Jewish teachings, and they would copy the scriptures in them. So we can take the targums that go way back to AD 200 and compare them with our text of 1008 and make a comparison to see the accuracy of that almost 1,000 years of transcribing. I believe because of the comparison we are able to make, that we can hold the Old Testament in our hand and say it is reliable. Now tomorrow I'll be going into archaeology, an archaeological confirmation of the Old Testament.